In the stock market world, there's a strategy called dollar cost averaging that helps fund managers and investors mitigate their risk. But how can this be applied to real estate investing? Today's guest is the head of a $14 billion alternative investing club, and he's opening up his due diligence and risk mitigation checklist on today's episode.
This is the Passive Real Estate Strategies Podcast, where we educate career-driven individuals who have tapped out their earning potential, learn about passive real estate investing so you can continue building your wealth without compromising your time or taking on more responsibilities. I'm your host and managing partner at Realm Investors, a multifamily syndication group who has helped multiply millions of dollars for our passive investors. Thanks for tuning in and let's get on with the show.
Hey investors, welcome to another episode of Passive Real Estate Strategy. Today, I am sitting down with Ian Ippolito. Now, Ian has been featured on USA Today, Bloomberg News, The Wall Street Journal, and so many more outlets about his seven-figure alternative investing portfolio and his private investing club, The Private Investor Club, with over 6,000 members and $14 billion in investable assets. Ian, we are excited to have you on the show and learn from you today.
Yeah, great to be here, Justin. Thanks so much.
Hey, so tell us about your journey as an investor, because you know you've had such accolades. You've been featured in so many areas, and you head a private investor club, which is fantastic. There's 6,000 members in that club, and you all collaborate and kind of bounce deals off of each other. So, how did you get to where you are today? Like, what's that investing journey look like?
Sure. So, originally, I was a serial tech entrepreneur. So it's like, you know, I guess way back, I was like, you know, I worked for someone else, and then I became a consultant, and then I became this tech entrepreneur. And, you know, that's a whole, I'm not even going to get into that, the whole thing on its own. But it's like each time I tried to build, you know, startups and companies that were did a little bit better than the last because I learned. Finally, at the end, I had a nice exit. And so then my job changed overnight. I was changing from being a person managing and running a company to managing and running my money. That was basically my new job. And so that's where I had previous investing experience, right? So like I've been in the stock market, you know, and stuff like that, but I never really got seriously into private placements and all the different types of non-traditional or alternative passive income that's out there. And that's what started it. And at the time, there was this thing called the Jobs Act where, you know, real estate crowdfunding was now becoming legal to do and there were ways to do it. So lots of new opportunities out there. And it was a little bit like the Wild West. It was like, well, which one do I pick? Yeah. And so I had free time because I didn't have a job. So so I went and I just investigated. I had like an assistant help me and I investigated all these different real estate platforms that were out there and interviewed people that were on them, asked them questions and kind of figure out which ones that I want to invest in. And what's funny is the word got out that I had created this big list, right? That like had all this information. And so I started giving it out to people and I just kept on getting all these requests. Can you please share with me the research that you did?
Yeah.
And one day I was like, you know what? Just go out to this web. I put it out on a website. It's on this website. And that website today is called the Real Estate Crowdfunding Review. And that's still there. And so basically that's what became the Real Estate Crowdfunding Review. So that's how I started.
And yeah. And since then, I mean, you've just continued to build upon that. Because I mean, I think that initial, you know, maybe couple months of learning is the hardest one, right? And you kind of build off of that. And so when you were looking at investments, was it all real estate at the time? And then now I think you've diversified into a couple more things. But what was that like?
Yes. Well, you know, as a retired entrepreneur, I was looking at a bunch of things. So I would say, yes, real estate very heavily. I was actually looking at like kind of like more active stuff, like buying franchises and things like that.
Yeah.
But as far as the passive stuff, yes. So it was mostly real estate because it was very difficult to get into some of the other stuff. I was interested, but it was hard to find.
Yeah.
So yeah, mostly real estate. And then over time, I found some of these other things too, which were very interesting and then got into those.
Yeah. I think that's a lot of ways that it starts. And as people invest more, they'll look for something exciting and new and like way more sophisticated, kind of piques their interest, right? It's like they learn about private debt and then they learn about different funds. They learn about VC funds. And it goes from like, oh, I want to own a couple of rentals to like, I want to do like music royalties or something like that. That's just so far beyond, right? So that's such a cool journey. So let's focus in on the real estate that you looked at. So were these, what type of investments? Because within just real estate, there's so many different niches and types. Yes. What types of things were you investing in back then? And is it the same kind of niches now, or have you evolved what your real estate holdings look like?
Sure. I mean, my very first one, and actually it was a bad investment, but it was basically residential real estate right at the wrong time. So it was right before the Great Recession hit, which of course was very, very difficult in single family housing. And it was a passive investment too. And at the time I knew very little about what to look at. I didn't understand real estate cycles. I didn't understand anything. I really didn't understand what I was getting into. All I knew was that, well, you know, I don't know what this thing is, so I'll have an attorney look at it, was what I thought. And so the attorney came back and said, well, you know, this is, now that attorney didn't know, in retrospect, they really didn't know anything about how all private placements work. They're all like this, but basically he said, well, gosh, you know, you're signing away all your rights because, you know, you don't have any rights to manage anything, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. That's the point. Right. But, and he's like, you really have to trust, you know, whoever it is, which is true. But he didn't really give me much after paying a bunch of money for that. So basically that was the due diligence that I did. And not understanding cycles and stuff like that, I jumped into this thing. And you know, I was very lucky. It took, I want to say, 12 to 14 years. First, it went down hugely. They spent a bunch of money. They lost a bunch of money. And slowly, they pivoted to multifamily. They started coming back. At the end, it ended up being break-even, which was like the luckiest thing ever. It easily could have been a complete loss of everything. So that was my first investment, which taught me a lot of lessons.
It's surprising that you continued on with it when your first one is such a poor experience, right? When it came to that deal, was it mostly that you invest, was it the timing that was bad? Or were there operations that were bad as well? Something that you maybe could have prevented in something that you look at now? Because it's tough to really time that market, right? There's things you could do.
It is.
Kind of dollar cost average your investments in a certain way by spreading out investments. But was there anything that, looking back, you could have done to prevent a deal like that? Was it the operator? Was it the business plan? Was it anything else besides just, hey, the timing was just off?
Yes. Well, there were other things I could have done. So now I did know enough. I was like, well, let me look at their track record. And they had 4 previous funds and they had all done well. But of course, it was all timing. It's like if you're in the upswing and everything is doing well, then I hit it right in the down.
Yeah.
So I looked at that. You know, that was fun. I didn't really know how to evaluate a sponsor as far as like how much skin in the game are they putting in? You know, is this leverage high or is this low? Are these chumps competitive with other offerings? Or then I didn't know any of that stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, the other thing I didn't realize, so I eventually came up with a strategy to kind of deal with the fact of the timing thing. Like I use a vintage year strategy, you know, and again, this is just for me. Everyone is different. Everyone has their own. Everyone's unique is what I like to say. It's like unique financial situation, unique risk tolerance, unique goals. So what I do is not necessarily going to work for anyone else, but it's what works for me. I use a vintage year strategy. So it's like I invest in, so if I was in the Great Recession, you know, I wasn't doing this then, but I would invest in 2008, which was like actually not a bad year, 2009, which was a terrible year, and then 2010, which actually was a really good year, like because after recessions, they can be extremely good years, 2010, 2011. So I spread my money out. I don't invest in any one single year. That's how I deal with that now. But at the time, I didn't know. So it was just like all in.
Yeah. And so what you are you talking about the vintage of the actual property or just the year that you're investing your money? So are you looking at all new builds and built in that year that are all brand new properties? Or is it just, hey, and you know, let's say this year, 2023, I'm going to invest, you know, $100,000 this year, and then I won't invest again until 2024. Or is that what you're talking about?
I try to, it can be tough to do. I try to make it just that year for the builds, if it's a build or if it's, say, just getting into it, like a value added, whenever that particular year, I try to do it for that year. It's not always possible because some of the funds are like multiple years and you can't do it. So then I just take that into account. But in general, like every year, I try to make sure there's a certain allocation that's put into like brand new stuff for that year.
Got it. Okay. And so, yeah. And essentially like dollar cost averaging, right? Anybody who's in the stock market, you know, you might invest, say, $100 every month, regardless of the price. As the way to kind of averages out. You're going to buy high sometimes, but sometimes you'll get lucky. You'll hit the lows.
Yes.
Exactly. I love that strategy. Now, how do you keep, so you mentioned a couple of other things, you know, the operator, skin of the game, you know, beyond their track record or their terms competitive, you know, what types of things do you look like? How has your due diligence list grown and refined since starting in that horrible deal, which part of it was time, right? But also just part of it is additional due diligence. Like, what does that checklist look like for you now? And how do you vet those things?
Yeah. Like at the time, my checklist was, you know, probably like a paragraph or two. Now, if I wrote it all out, like it would be pages and pages. But to just briefly, you know, it's like, yeah, so the first thing I do is I actually, you know, and everyone does it differently. Some people start with the sponsor first. Some people start with the deal first and they look at the sponsor. I actually go the opposite way. So I look at the sponsor first. And then if I like the sponsor, then I will bother to go into the deal. And my thinking is that, you know, a decent, really good sponsor can take like an average deal and make it good. And if it goes bad, they have the resources to turn it around versus, you know, and this is because I'm a conservative investor, but you know, and a different investor will look at it differently. But, you know, a sponsor that I don't feel as comfortable about, maybe they have a great deal, but if something goes wrong, you know, then all of a sudden they might not have the ability to keep it a great deal.
Yeah.
So again, and I'm looking at it from a conservative point of view where it's like my number one thing is protecting my principal, which is not everyone's goal. Like depending on where someone is in life, you know, they might be looking to just grow. That might be the most important thing or, you know, whatever it is. But for me, it's protecting the principal. So yes, so that's kind of like what I would do basically for that.
Hey, investor, did you know that we wrote an ebook that covers the three truly passive real estate strategies that exist to retail investors? Head to the link in the show notes and download our free ebook, The Definitive Guide to Passive Real Estate Strategies. We'll walk you through the three truly passive investment strategies so you can build your wealth without sacrificing your time or compromising your hours. Head to the show notes and get your free download. Let's get back to the show.
Okay. And I like what you said about, I mean, there's different phases of your investing career. I call it playing offense or playing defense.
Oh, okay.
Now, right? A ton of principal and you're just like, hey, I'm really good if I never make another dollar. I just need to keep as much as I can. Look, you're kind of playing defense, right? You don't need heavy value adds or those very quick, big equity multiple plays. Other people, like just me, my personal taste, I'm okay taking on a little bit more risk with my investments. I'm okay putting up into more aggressive strategies to really double my income as fast as I can. So yeah, I love the different strategies there. So when you're looking at that sponsor, you know, what are some of the other things that you look for in terms of, you know, just beyond their track record? And like you said, market cycles help that a lot, right? I mean, everybody's track record the past 2 years is like phenomenal. You know, we
exactly
our investments, you know, it doesn't really matter. You know, what are some other ways that you check out that sponsor? What are the biggest non-negotiables that you have?
Yeah. So for me, exactly what you're talking about there is that's kind of the biggest thing. So when I evaluate them, what I really like to see is that they have at least one full real estate cycle experience. So I can see how they did in the up, I can see how they did in the down. And there's a few that might even have multiple cycles. Then that's like really, really good. And then I take a look at that and I go, well, did they like collapse during the down? Or, you know, did they do all right? And maybe they lost money on a few deals. Does happen, but, you know, are they pretty much okay? And there's a few that have barely lost any money or maybe even never lost money on deals in down times because they're very conservatively set up. So that's what I look for, number one. So I see that sponsor with that full track record and the history that makes me feel comfortable. I'm like, okay, now I found a sponsor I like. I'm going to really look at every single deal that comes out and find out if I like these particular deals or funds or not. And then I kind of go into the next levels of
my deals. Yeah. And how do you check that? Is it more so just asking them for, hey, you know, that point you have to think they have to be in business for about 10 years, right? That's the loose rule. I mean, the market cycle is about every 10 years. So are you just asking for every single deal that they've done in the past, let's just say 10 years, or how do you vet for that? How do you check that?
Yeah, I mean, I actually want to see them all. And it's interesting. It can be hard to get it all because you say, hey, I want to see your track record, and they'll send you something. And sometimes it'll be, well, these are just our realized deals. So, and if your investors, you know, or if your audience knows, it's like realized means just sold. And they may be carrying a bunch of stuff that may or may not be as good. So I go, well, you know what? Thanks, but I want everything. I want your realized and your unrealized deals. And I want performance statistics on everything. And if it's audited, I want to see the audits, you know, and all that sort of stuff. So I go as deeply as I can. And not every deal is audited. So, you know, I have to feel comfortable like, okay, well, this is not audited. Usually what I do in that case is like, well, what if I tell them, hey, can I have the right to audit you if I choose? And to me, that's like a good thing, good question to ask, because if they go, they start backing away, that's like, great, thank you, I'm done. But they're like, oh yeah, no problem. You can audit at any time at your own expense. Then I'll continue looking at them.
Tell us more about that, because I feel like that's more of an in-depth strategy or question that we haven't really covered on the show before. So would you say, you know, have these deals been audited? Mm-hmm. What exactly does that mean?
Yeah. Okay. So I'd say maybe the typical deal, I don't know, it depends on what someone's looking at, but a lot of times the deals are not audited, meaning you know, the sponsor produces the financials. It comes from their accountant, and their accountant just puts it out at the end of the year. Now, if they go an additional step and they have an audit, what happens is at the end of the year, an auditor then goes and looks at those results, and they will do a bunch of double checks. Like, they'll look, okay, let's look at the bank account and see if these distributions that are claimed really went out. Let's see if these capital calls actually match. Let's see if, oh, there's a valuation at the end. You know, there's a lot of leeway that can go into a valuation. So they go, let's see if these inputs into the valuation look reasonable or not. So the auditor goes in and looks at a bunch of stuff. Now, the auditor will tell you, they cannot guarantee that they will catch all fraud, right? It's impossible to do. It's just an additional check that when it's there, it is really nice because it's like a third party saying, hey, you know, they check these things.
Yeah. And so when you're asking if you can audit, so if they say, and again, not terribly common, say, yeah, we audit every single property.
Yes.
Well, that's maybe not necessarily a red flag. But if you choose to audit them yourself, you know, what does that process look like? Is it very expensive for you? Is it something that you do on every single deal? Or is it, hey, once you've done it once or twice on the sponsor, you feel good about it? You know, what does that look like if you do ask, can I audit you? And they say yes. What do you do then?
I mean, I guess I should answer from, like, you can almost do a spectrum of things there as far as what you want to do on your own audit. I mean, in the, for example, I'm thinking of one, and I'm not going to mention any names, but I'll just say, you know, in the club, there were some investors that were concerned about one particular deal. And one of the club members was an accountant. So he said, hey, you know, part of our rights is that we have access to the books. So I'm not going to like have an auditor come in there, but I would like to go in and take a look at these books. And because the person was an accountant, they were able to go in and you know, look at the books and kind of come up with their own idea. That's kind of like one level of audit. Another would be maybe if someone's not an accountant, you know, maybe it's just like, there's very things that can be easily understood even by an accountant who knows about, you know, real estate and right. Stuff like that. So maybe if they're that level. But then there's also the other level of like you hire, you know, a third party to go in there, and it is more formal and it is expensive. So it's probably not something that most people are going to do. But, you know, there's a spectrum of things.
Yeah. Okay. So you can really dive in, but because of the cost associated with it, it's probably not economical to do that with every deal that you get. You maybe do that.
Right.
It's on the sponsor if you're really going to put up a lot of money. Even then, a lot of sponsors may shy away from that if you are, and you talk about this as a benefit of the club. You know, if you're a single investor and you're going to put up, you know, maybe $20,000, $50,000 to go through with a full audit on that, you know, you might get a little bit of pushback just because, like, man, it's just a ton of time and energy and cost commitment. More, what's relatively speaking, a small investment. Right? But one of the benefits of a club like yours is you actually say, hey, we have 6,000 members in this club. You know, we've invested this year, whatever, millions of dollars. It's worth it for us to audit these things and kind of use the fund of the club to justify those larger expenses. That's pretty much the job of the club. Is that why you created it?
Well, one of the three reasons was like due diligence. So yeah, it kind of falls under due diligence. And then the other was like just to find new sponsors was another reason. And the third was, you know, sometimes they'll give us special deals that they won't give. Like, you know, if I bring just my little amount of money,
sure,
they don't really care. But if there's, like you said, if there's a whole bunch of people coming, they might give me a special deal. But, you know, so it does kind of fall in there. The other thing I'll add is that maybe as an individual investor, say you're an individual investor and putting in just a small amount of money, say you're putting in $25,000, it's like maybe that is generating, I don't know, it's probably not generating a ton of money each year, and you're already paying for, like, you know, taxes and K-1s, maybe you're paying your accountant and stuff like that, it may not even be worth. So it's like, you know, definitely everyone has to kind of judge what makes sense to them.
Yeah. Well, I like that. Now tell us about the private investor club now. So we kind of touched on it. There's about 6,000 members in it. I mean, billions of dollars in investable assets. Is that predominantly real estate, or what kind of niches are you guys getting into in that club now?
So it covers all alternative, but because real estate is just a huge portion of it, it's like maybe 60 to 70% real estate. And there are other things that are just more niche kind of investments. There's, like you mentioned, music royalties. There's litigation finance. There's life settlements. So there's all these things that are, you know, in a way similar to real estate because they're not directly tied to the business cycle. It's like you've got the business cycle in the stock market, which is pretty volatile.
Yeah.
And you've got real estate, which, you know, there's definitely recessions where real estate just keeps on chugging, you know? So, and then these have their own unique cycles. So I like them because, like, I feel like in a diversified portfolio, I kind of want, like, you know, something that's going up while something's going down.
Yeah.
And, you know, to have as many of these going on as possible.
Yeah. So that diversification is super cool to have and really awesome to have access to. Now, when it comes to the real estate assets that you've seen in that club, how are you seeing the investing in real estate evolve? Like before, you knew you mentioned residential stuff. Are you still like residential? Do you like another niche right now? It's something that you see as being an up and coming, you know, asset class or niche? Or tell us about, I guess, the cycles of what you're investing in now in real estate.
Yeah. Well, okay. So I'd say 2 years ago, before interest rates started rising, everyone became very concerned, like, is a recession happening like right now? My goal was like, make it as recession proof as possible. So, you know, so I started off, I actually have a core portfolio of like single family residential houses. And because I'm so conservative, and this may not be a match for everyone, but it's a match for me. It's like, I don't actually have any debt on those. And what that does is like a core thing that I can go, you know what, I can count on that. Recession comes, there's no debt on it. The odds of losing the house is like so small. So that enables me, that's like the core, that enables me on the satellite portion of my portfolio to take more risk. And so on the satellite portions that are smaller, that's where I have, so first I would move into like, for example, like multifamily, which most people would actually not consider to be high risk, but you know, compared to having no debt, it is.
Right.
So, you know, so yep. So I started off doing multifamily and a lot of that. And multifamily has done well. It's done extremely well over the last several years. But things are starting to slow down, you know, we're at least in the last year or so, you know, some of these multifamily deals, depending on how they're structured, you know, income is going down. Maybe there are some, unfortunately, a few maybe are having difficulty with debt payments, you know, whatever it is. So, you know, so there's some stress going on there. And so in the short term, you know, I believe in multifamily long term, but, you know, I'm not focusing like I was, you know, like on everything that comes in. I have like a couple sponsors that I like doing with the vintage year strategy where they have like a long-term focus. They are very conservatively leveraged, which is like the big thing I want to see. Yeah. It's like, you know, so I will still do that, but it's not like as big as it was for me a couple of years ago.
Yeah. What is big for you right now? Is there another asset class that you like? Is it whether it's real estate or not? Or, you know, what are you like most excited about? If you get a deal today and it's in this type of asset that you're just like, oh my God, this is like exactly what I was looking for. Is there an asset class that comes to mind or a certain niche that comes to mind that you're excited about like today?
Like today. Well, I tell you what a lot of people like, and it's just not a fit for me, but like, for example, mobile home parks, a lot of people love them. Now, just because, hey, if we're in a recession, they tend to be very recession proof. And, you know, it's the housing of last resort. So it's like, you know, people, they do everything they can to stay in it. So it's very sticky. Yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of people that do like that. But personally, I don't actually invest in that. I make all decisions with my wife and, you know, there's just the concerns about it is the housing of last resort and, you know, and some of the ethics. So I don't, but a lot of people love that. So I can tell you a lot of people are looking at that right now and they're looking at things like self-storage, for example. So maybe it's not like the traditional multifamily real estate investment, but it's something that also tends to be very recession resistant because if we are in a recession or coming up one, people still need a place to, in the past recessions, they still need a place to store their stuff. And in fact, if they have to move out of the house, a lot of times they need it even more than normal.
Yeah.
So self-storage, mobile home parks, things like that in real estate. And then outside of real estate, yes, I mean, I love those other classes. So it's like, you know, the litigation finance. So what litigation finance is, it's completely unrelated to the business cycle. So litigation finance is like, hey, I'm going to finance these court cases. If they win, I get a certain amount of money off of them. And so whether that happens or not, it's completely independent of the business cycle. So that's a great diversifier. So I've got those that I love. Yeah. So the music royalties are nice because again, they're not tied to the business cycle. Life settlements is another one, which is basically life insurance policies. And when people pass away, they paid off on. So that happening is not really tied to the business cycle either. So all these kind of things, and whenever I see something that's an alternative investment like that's not tied, I get excited.
Yeah, wow, that's really alternative, right? A lot of
yes,
you know, that's a way that which is exciting, right? A lot of people love to invest in things that almost other people have never heard of.
Yes, yeah,
makes them excited, right? So whenever mm-hmm. ask, what's that mean? They're like, yes, like now I get a chance to talk about this thing. So
something new.
Yeah, hey, that's fantastic. I think this episode has been super, super valuable. You know, tell us about the Private Investor Club. Where can people get more information about that? And then any other final thoughts that you have as we wrap up the show?
Sure. So www.privateinvestorclub.com. People can go there, see all the information, how the club works. Those three things I told you about, the purpose of the club. If they're interested, they can sign up. And that's where I can be reached too. And I don't think I have anything else other than just to say thanks and thanks for spending time with me and letting me talk to your audience.
Yeah, absolutely. So listeners, we're going to put that link in the show notes. While you're there, of course, if you haven't already, make sure you download our free book, The Definitive Guide to Passive Real Estate Strategies. Ian, it's been fantastic having you on the show.
Same here, Justin.
Well, that's it for today's show. Make sure you subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. And if you're looking to learn more about passive real estate investments, make sure you head to our show notes and download our free ebook, The Definitive Guide to Passive Real Estate Strategies, where we reveal the ins and outs of the truly passive ways to invest in real estate. We'll see you on the next episode.